It is a tangled web that ties together the pain and the promise of the beloved community we've always sought. Put your ear to the constant clamor of violence and you will hear a soft plea for mercy. Look close enough and all these illusions of separateness begin to fade, these neat categories of black and white, us and them, inside God's grace and out. All these begin to break down. Remove all the fear, and it's suddenly possible to imagine how we could all stand up and get it together for one great collective cause. Someday, it may be possible for a great mosaic of hope to emerge from the shards of this spite and malice. Militant apathy will become the catalyst for empathy, the kind that softens hardened hearts and heals a tired and tender world. Someday, courage and vision will not hesitate to take the stand whenever inherent worth is put on trial. Until that day, we will watch people trade commodities of fear, and few may notice as cynicism replaces prayer, as the glass drops below half full, or when doubt becomes our daily bread. The stories that I tell this morning are all our story. They have been told and retold the world over. Each time there is a hope in the telling that people will finally begin to hear the flat notes as the angel sings, mercy. And they will begin to ask themselves, what has become of us? And wonder aloud if we've come too far to turn it around. Remember last year how the city of Boston was placed in lockdown while the people there and the nation held its breath, searching for the culprits who stole our collective sense of security. Two bombs exploded at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Crude devices spewing scrap metal like hate unleashed on an unsuspecting crowd. Martin Richard, an 8-year-old boy, was killed, as was Lou Lingzi, a foreign exchange student, and Crystal Campbell, a young restaurant worker. The media reported hundreds in critical condition. The suspects, they said, were foreign-born and ferociously armed. Explosive debates over legislation on guns and immigration emerged anew. We learned that the suspects were brothers, both born in a country 9 out of 10 Americans could not find on a map, and certainly not in their heart. Both born with given names too hard to pronounce unless we had sat together and broken bread as family. The media responded to the violence with violence, calling for justice, somewhat akin to the old vigilante mobs, throwing details of differences and prejudices like chum for sharks while the world held its breath, waiting for justice to be served. We, who are human, were not built to hold such tragedy. So much fear gets poured into our DNA, passed on to the people that we love through dinner table prejudice. How does innocence have a conversation with evil? How can an angry mob be curious about the plight of the weak and the vulnerable? How can we learn to stand in a single line and pass from hand to hand bread and medicine to the victims after the levees holding back our fear are breached? One August day 1930, another version of the story. Two young men, Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith, were hung from a tree before hundreds of citizens who gathered to watch in the Marion, Indiana town square. These young black men were arrested after Claude Dieter, a white factory worker, was murdered and his female companion announced that she had been raped. A declaration, by the way, that occurred in more than one-third of the lynchings in this country. There was no trial. On the evening of their arrest, a small mob gathered and broke into the jail where the three boys were being held. They brought sledgehammers and crowbars to break down those walls of justice, but no one in that crowd asked on which side of those walls they stood when they picked up their tools and which side they stood on when they put them down. They pulled the three black men from their cells, demanding that justice be done, and everyone in that town knew what that meant. Word got out, so families came bringing their young. The justice which had gone missing was about to be restored, and that was something they wanted their children to see. After the first two boys were hung, they made sure to pose for the local photographer, who took pictures of the event, pictures that they felt certain would show the future what justice looked like. I have known people who scorn the church, having patched so many holes in their pants from years of kneeling in pews too hard for their soft hearts to find rest. They would talk about how their goodness was talked out of them by the stories of being raised in the garden of an angry and vengeful God. But I say, it is we who get up every morning and write the new covenant ever since our lease on that garden was revoked. We are in charge of what happens in this garden. We hire the exterminators and walk the grounds and trap and rid paradise of all the serpents and spiders that live in our imagination. Having power over life and death is a holy thing, but standing on holy ground is hard on the feet, which explains the shuffling of the crowd. In that shuffling, hardly anyone noticed when James Cameron, the third boy arrested and brought to the town square, had slipped away during the commotion of picture-taking and self-commendations. But vengeance, once fed, develops an appetite. Cameron called one low voice, and then another, and then a chant formed. We want Cameron. We want Cameron. With the glee of a home crowd summoning a favorite football star to the field. The face of the town's sheriff was nervous and covered in sweat as he turned to the mob leader. Go on, get the hell out of here, he said. You already hung two of them. That ought to satisfy you. But reason takes no root in the dry, hard pan of apathy and anger. So when Cameron came into view, the crowd got louder, pushing him back in place under the tree holding his two friends. He carried the look of a drowning man swallowed by a sea of fear, not only his own. He scoured the faces of the people that he passed, searching for any sign of mercy, but saw none. They got a rope, Mr. Cameron remembered, and they put it around my neck, and they began to push me under the tree. His reflections are offered in hindsight and recorded as history because James Cameron did not die that day. But he does reveal that thing which had the power to turn the rabid crowd from its prey. James Cameron lived not because of his own pleas, nor those of the sheriff, but from the cries of a single, lone, unidentified man who stood up on the hood of his car, parked on a street off to the side of the town square and called out for the people to stop. Mercy. Mercy, he called. Some say that lone man turned the lemming crowd from the moral cliff. Some say he single-handedly saved a life from being strangled by blind vengeance. We seem to like theories like that. One man, one action, one perfect moment can do anything and turn everything around. I like to think it was more than that, because I know it will take more than that. It is a tangled web, and there are two ways that you can be a spider. You can work to address the real pest population, reduce the number of cockroaches and mosquitoes and aphids that carry disease toward our children and make the garden untenable for creation. Or you can harbor fangs and carry venom, build sticky webs, trap prey, eat baby birds, devour your own species, maybe even your mate. Either way, you are simply a spider, true to everything you were born to be, carrying within you the power to spin webs and capture prey, but also the power to weave together strands that communicate the struggle of something caught in that web years ago. Abel Meeropol was a teacher and a poet. He wrote a poem about the pain he felt after seeing the postcard made of the photograph taken in the Marion Town Square of Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith, who were hung from that tree. Abel Meeropol was a Jew in the Bronx, 1,000 miles away, but he had enough distance to see that his whole world was woven into the same racial and social and cultural and religious web. And like the strands from which those two boys were hung, he knew that he too could be regarded as prey to the spider whose hunger blinds him from reason. Some trees bear strange fruit, Meeropol mused as he saw the photo. He noticed in the picture how the crowd displayed cavalier expressions where he expected them to hold looks of horror. From this, he began to understand how the world could compartmentalize people if it is run by those who compartmentalize their feelings and their loyalty. Trees of prejudice grow from seeds of love fertilized by fear. He wrote the poem under the pseudonym Lewis Allen because of the reality of anti-Semitism, which made it clear that such trees stand at the center of almost every garden. Abel's namesake, born outside the garden, was led by his brother Cain into the field and killed. Sacrificed is the word some preachers use to describe the slain, but sacrifice has a dignity to it which makes it inaccurate. Am I my brother's keeper? Was the question asked by Cain. It might also have been the question on the lips of every single person in the Marion Town Square that day as they lit the match that still burns in our conscience. But only the voice of God shouting from the hood of a car had the power to call the spider back. When police caught up to the suspects who planted the bombs in Boston, the news described a standoff, both sides heavily armed. The shootout lasted for hours and ended only when one brother was fatally shot and run over by the other brother as he raced away from the scene of the crime. Police caught up with the surviving outlaw the next day, hiding in a small boat, hoping perhaps to sail somewhere not quite so crazy, hoping perhaps to live in a world a little less wrapped and warped by fear. But there he was, anchored in the one world he was born into. I am glad that they caught him, said someone who worked in the trauma ward at Mass General that treated the 260 people injured "I'm glad he's alive," said a police officer, who could now breathe a sigh of relief and get on to the question of whether to pursue the death penalty. Abel Meeropol published his poem in the New York Teacher Journal and the Marxist publication The New Masses. He used the pseudonym Lewis Allen, taking his pen name from the first names of his two sons, Lewis and Allen, both arriving stillborn, both understanding what it's like when you aren't given a chance. It's possible that Meeropol knew the tragedy of Billie Holiday's life when he showed her the poem at the club in New York City where he went to hear her sing. It's possible that he was aware of how she was overpowered and raped by a man when she was 12, or how she turned to prostitution at 14. And it's possible that he recognized that there was no one who came with sledgehammers and crowbars to break her out of the prison sentence she served every day. And it's possible that he knew how many drinks and drugs and other distractions she needed to salve the shape of emptiness in the center of her soul. Or perhaps he only recognized the voice of an angel who could sing the word of God as it carried over our heads. The kind of angel willing to stand up in a basement bar or on the hood of a car and call a callous world to its senses. Whatever the reason, Strange Fruit became Holiday's signature song, reaching number 16 on the popular charts. But when it was released, Time magazine denounced the song as a prime piece of musical propaganda for the NAACP. Though he managed to write a few songs for Frank Sinatra and Peggy Lee earlier, Meeropol stopped getting work as a writer in the 1950s due to the Red Scare of McCarthyism. Perhaps that gave him the time and maybe even gave him the reason to adopt two young boys, orphaned sons of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, the ones convicted of treason and espionage, trading national secrets during the race to build the world's first atomic weapon. That case swept the country into hysteria, and the Rosenbergs were declared guilty and executed. Nobel Prize-winning playwright Jean-Paul Sartre described the case as, quote, "a legal lynching which smears with blood a whole nation." The two boys were lost in the madness. From the time of their parents' arrest and even after the execution, the Rosenberg boys were passed from one home to another. First one grandmother looked after them, then another, then friends, and for a brief spell they were sent to a shelter. The paranoia of the McCarthy era was such that many people, even family members, were terrified of being connected with the Rosenberg children, and many people who might have cared for them were too afraid to do so. Am I my brother's keeper? Has always been a question of timid and tender conviction. Billie Holiday introduced Strange Fruit to a Greenwich Village Cafe society in 1939. It always came at the end of her set. Each time she sang, it sounded like the voice of an angel singing about the work of the devil. The waiters at the Sheridan Square Basement Club would suspend service so the room was quiet. Holiday was illuminated by a small pin light on her face, which went dark at the song's end. There were no curtain calls, no encores. Abel Meeropol is dead, as is his namesake from the Bible, as are Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith. Billie Holiday is dead, as are Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. Martin Richard, Lou Lingsey, and Crystal Campbell are dead, guilty of standing too close to the bombs which detonated at the Boston Marathon last year. Tamerlan Sameyev who built the bombs is dead, which some will argue is justice and a good thing. Some might conclude that his brother Zokar is as good as dead, just like the media that covered the story and the empathy that got lost in the madness and the justice we all hope to find. It is when we notice that angels sing in basements and spiders run the world that it begins to feel like we are all descendants of Cain. There were many left in critical condition after the violence in Boston. They numbered in the hundreds at Mass General. They number in the billions around the planet. Whether any of them come back to life or not depends on how many people stop and stand up for where we need to be when they hear the angel song. People change. Hearts change. Minds change all the time. Our culture changes sometimes too slowly to keep our hearts from breaking. But broken hearts are really the very thing that help us hear the angel's song. When enough people listen to the angels singing of brokenness, people will change. Institutions will change. How else can we explain that Time magazine in 1999 named Strange Fruit the song of the century? Over our heads, there is trouble in the air, but there is music and there is singing. Listen, and you will hear angels sequestered in basements and singing from the hoods of cars, and you will know there must be a God somewhere. The morning after the Boston tragedy, my alarm went off. These days, alarms on cell phones are rather sophisticated. I have mine set to play a Dave Matthews song. As I listened, it occurred to me that if God were at the Boston Marathon, she might well have been on a side street, standing on the hood of her car. And as people ran by, I think this is what she might have sung. Don't give up. I know you can see all the world and the mess that we're making. Can't give up and hope God will intercede. Come on back. Imagine that we could get it together. Stand up for what we need to be, because crime won't save or feed a hungry child. Can't lay down and hope that miracles will intercede. Lift up your eyes, lift up your heart, and sing mercy. What will become of us? Have we come too far to turn it around? Can we carry on just a little bit longer?